Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Inside Julia's Kitchen is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill. Employee-owned Bob's Red Mill offers organic, gluten-free, stone-ground products. Visit bobsredmill.com today.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, a podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome Chef Danielle Blood, acclaimed chef and leading Franco-American restaurateur, humanitarian, cookbook author, and recipient of so many prestigious awards, I don't really have time to name them all, but trust me, they're all the very best ones. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Danielle about French chef Paul Bocuse's legacy, the global Bocuse d'Or cooking competition, and our last segment, I'm eagerly awaiting Danielle's Julia moment. We'll be right back. In the first part of Inside Julia's Kitchen, we launched the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. At the risk of stating the obvious, few things were more important to Julia than France and French food. Not only did she consider France and its food the epitome of what it means to cook and eat well, but France was her spiritual home, where she had that aha moment that inspired her then lifelong passion. Another of Julia's passions was giving back, and to Julia that also very much meant giving back to her profession. She gave back as both a leader and a teacher, and not just to the public at large, but to those she worked with. Her commitment to the profession was everlasting and extensive. It would be impossible to list all the organizations to which Julia lent her time and energy. But chief among them were PBS, the International Association of Culinary Professionals, the James Beard House, and the American Institute for Wine and Food. When you think about people following in Julia's footsteps, Chef Danielle Blood has very similar devotions to Julia. A passion for bringing the best of French food at all levels to Americans from his home base at his flagship restaurant Danielle in New York City, from where he leads a team running a scant 13 restaurants in 7 cities in 4 countries around the world. So it's difficult to think of someone more dedicated to his craft and profession than Danielle. Despite all that he oversees, Danielle still devotes a lot of time to giving back, and I mean giving back in a serious way. A passionate supporter of training other chefs to excel in the profession, he is tireless, and I mean I do not understand where his boundless energy comes from, but I suspect the secret could be eating a lot of fresh truffles, he can tell us later. I can think of no one better to talk about the legacy of Danielle's own mentor, Chef Paul Bocuse. Bocuse, fondly referred to by his own devoted mentees and fans as Monsieur Paul, and also known as the Pope of French cooking, Monsieur Paul sadly died at the tender age of 91 in January, and like Julia, just short of his 92nd birthday. So this felt like the right moment to examine his legacy, and there's no one better informed than Danielle. Welcome to the podcast, Danielle.
Hello, Todd, and I'm so happy to be sharing this moment with you and your listener.
Well, I'm really grateful you could be here. We're kicking off season two, and to do so to share your insights about Monsieur Paul and the Bocuse d'Or. But I wanted to start off talking kind of specifically about Bocuse and who he was as a person, and particularly who he was to you. And you once said that he was the greatest influence on your life since you began cooking, which is a pretty big statement. And so I wanted to ask you, why has he particularly been so personally important to you?
Well, I grew up in Lyon, outside of Lyon, and Paul Bocuse, of course, being the Pope of French cuisine, he was definitely in Lyon, the most important person within the world of cooking. And I started at 14, and my first week at work was to go to Les Halles, the central market of Lyon, and go with my boss and help him carry the boxes from Les Halles to the restaurant. And my new boss at 14 was the best friend of Paul Bocuse. So, of course, he proudly presented his new apprentice. And, of course, Paul Bocuse gave me a tap on the back and, you know, kind of a welcome kid. But, you know, no relationship, just like for me to witness such a giant in cooking already, because he was already, and I'm talking 1969, so that's not yesterday. It's a yesteryear. And and he was already such a powerful man within his own town. Everyone count on him, listen to him, venerate him, but also really he was the leader of a movement we just started around that time, which was Nouvelle Cuisine. And I think I have seen so many generation of chef during that period who were counting on Paul Bocuse's support in order to be sort of like making sure that they were in the right track, that they were included in his circle as well. And what's beautiful at that time is then, and we see it in every generation of chef, there is a little bit of a circle was created among the same generation of chef who are making some change or creating some food, who are sort of identifying the time. And
but Danielle, do you think there's something about Monsieur Paul that was special in terms of his ability to work with and mentor and train other chefs? Because there are plenty of other people on the scene who made some sort of impact, but not to develop the kind of devotion, particularly amongst other chefs, that Bocuse earned.
Very much. And I think at the time, what I witnessed when Paul Bocuse really started to become one of the most important chefs in France, is that he belonged also to those association of restaurants such as Tradition et Qualité, Les Grandes Tables du Monde, or Relais Chateau. And this was kind of it was not a club, but it was also, beside being restaurateur associated under one group of restaurant, they were also exchanging chef. They were making sure that it became also a school of excellence. And where a chef coming from a colleague of this association coming to work with him, or him, Paul Bocuse, passing along one of his young chefs who had worked maybe a couple of years with him and now need to move on to Eberlin, or Trois Gros, or Chapelle, or Pic, or Roger Verger, or Michel Guérard. At the time, there was always this trading happening of chef, but there was also a lot about making sure that if you find talent, you need to help them grow and you need to help them have access. And it's, you know, having a reference from your previous chef is the best thing you can ask. You can, of course, always send your resume and wish they're going to take you. But one phone call does it rather than, in those days, one phone call was more important than sending a resume.
Where do you think that came from, though, with Bocuse, in the sense of, again, I don't think everyone, while that's very familiar to you because you have led by that example, it's not necessarily the norm. If every chef did that, we would have a very different restaurant and kitchen culture. Where did this devotion to the profession and to that camaraderie, do you think, came from with Bocuse?
I think with Paul Bocuse, it was definitely camaraderie and respect and... they all had the same ambition, but no one wanted to be exactly the same. And so it became a very big school of learning because each chef, I mean, when you take a chef like Alain Sandorens versus Trois Gros versus Verger, they were three very different styles and three very different disciplines. And as a young chef, the importance was to do your Tour de France. And the Tour de France was to go from at least three or four restaurant chefs, or five maybe in your career as a young chef, to be able to learn from them. And I think Paul Bocuse was very open to that. But Paul Bocuse is also a meilleur ouvrier de France. He was very ambitious as a chef. He was very driven. And meilleur ouvrier de France is... one of the most prestigious reward, I mean, not only reward, but competition you can do in France. And that gives you the possibility of becoming every 4 years, they have maybe 20 chosen chef, or between 12 and 20 chosen chef in France who become meilleur ouvrier de France. And that is something who Paul Bocuse, as a chef, became a meilleur ouvrier de France, and then he became a leader in that field. He became also very, very involved and engaged with training young chefs to become meilleur ouvrier de France as well. And so when you go today in the restaurant Paul Bocuse, beside all the chefs who has left him, and earned the meilleur ouvrier de France, but the chef were working with him, there is, I think, within the restaurant L'Auberge, I think there is five meilleur ouvrier de France, five or six there, including service, including wine service, and of course in the kitchen. But then if you go to his brasserie in Lyon, Brasserie de l'Est, Brasserie de l'Ouest, he has also a cluster of meilleur ouvrier de France there. So... And those meilleurs ouvriers de France, their responsibility is to teach the next generation as well of becoming a meilleur ouvrier de France, or at least to become a great chef.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you. It's almost, there is a self interest in it, right? Because classically the tradition was you apprentice to become a chef. There still isn't as much a cooking school culture in France. And that in some ways, if you want to guarantee keep doing food and keep expanding at the level you want to do it at, you need really talented people coming up to help you?
Very much. And also, let's face it, I mean, Paul was very creative, but he had huge respect for tradition and huge passion for tradition. And for him, first and foremost, it was all about French cuisine. I think today, a chef is much more open to a globalization of flavor versus Paul was very focused on French cuisine. And I think to become a great French chef, you almost had, it was almost a passage of ritual of having to work for one of the great chefs like him.
Hmm. So I heard Jacques Pepin once said about Bocuse that he did more than any other chef in the world to bring chefs into the dining room and to make the profession respectable and to make us who we are now. And I think that quote that was from 2011. And I think to someone younger, that's a bit of a perplexing quote. Like, well, aren't chefs already, you know, respectable and desired and people want to commune with them in the dining room? But I think Pepin was talking about the time back, maybe closer to 1969. So what's your view of what Jacques was talking about there?
Of course. And I think Paul Bocuse, early on, very in the early days already, when he redid his kitchen, when I visited the kitchen of Paul Bocuse the first time, is basically, as you walk into the restaurant, there's a big window overlooking the entire kitchen. And the stove area and all the hot lines and a part of the kitchen. And I think also the guest was always invited to come and visit the kitchen. And, of course, Paul Bocuse had his presence in the dining room as well. And I think this became almost like with Nouvelle Cuisine, the new generation of chef. The chef was presented as an artist as well, not only just a laborer on the back, but he was also Paul Bocuse wanted to make sure that, you know, if you buy the best ingredient, if you make the best cooking, then be proud to just, you know, don't hide yourself in the back, and really communicate about it. And be able to communicate, be able to make people feel special by what you do. And I think today, of course, Paul Bocuse have opened many restaurants during his career, especially in Lyon. I'm looking at Lyon, and he had created those brasseries where the entire kitchen is open into the dining room. And this is not a novelty today, but, you know, 20 years ago and all that, it wasn't so familiar than the entire kitchen was open. And he was while he was very traditional, he always liked new things. He always wanted to bring new things. He always wanted to also make himself accessible to his local clientele. He knew that not everybody could afford to go to Paul Bocuse every day, but they could almost afford to go to this brasserie every day.
Yeah, no, and that goes into, I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, when Bocuse was cooking, because traditionally or historically, France certainly had chefs as celebrated artists, if you go back to people like Carême, but maybe, do you think it was because of having survived first World War I and then World War II, a lot of that ability to luxuriate in the chef as artist and in food had to be put on the back burner and was almost, maybe not erased, but certainly lost? And do you think that it was that post-war emergence that kind of, and then he just put a kind of newer spin on it?
Oh, very much. And you have to remember that before Paul Bocuse, it was Fernand Point. It was, there were maybe a dozen of chefs in France who were starting to really make an impact in the industry. And this was really post-war, and Paul Bocuse came after that a little bit as a professional, and in his reputation he was more in the 60s, but I'm talking like late 40s, 50s, 60s. Fernand Point was the driving force of the cuisine lyonnaise with La Mère Brasier, with many of Joannès Nandron, who was the father of my the chef I was working for when I was an apprentice, and they were all the driving force, and they were all focusing on changing the cuisine already from Escoffier, but also because Escoffier had become more of a continental cuisine, and Fernand Point was more about coming back to the local ingredient, and you know, maybe Escoffier said to do this way and this way, but he wasn't taking note. He wasn't putting importance on the locality of things, more on the technique and the recipe, versus Fernand Point was really putting a strong emphasis on the ingredient itself, the locality, and I think the suppliers. And I think Paul Bocuse, it was a déclic, because he felt and what he learned at Fernand Point was so personal as a cuisine and all that, and he got to continue in that journey with himself and to bring everybody with it.
Yeah, that just reminded me of sort of the idea, too, of bringing in regionalism. Once sort of an Escoffier standard was global, then you had to figure out ways to be more distinct. And that reminded me of, you know, Anne Willen taught me the proper way to make a French omelette. And then I was watching Julia do it, and Julia did it entirely differently. And then I realized the proper way to make an omelette, or particularly the French way to make an omelette, is entirely dependent on the French chef who's taught you to make that omelette.
Totally. And omelette, I mean, every chef thinks there is a way to make an omelette. Some like to cook it slow, some like to cook it fast, some like to cook it...
But they will tell you this is the one way, right, to properly cook an omelette in French cooking.
Some like to think that it has to have a little bit of a color, and some other think that there should not absolutely be any color on the omelette. Paul Bocuse is... For that, he knew very well his classic, and he could, and he had also a lot of passion for a certain rusticity in the cuisine, and yet the part of the menu was evolving all the time and creating new classic, and part of the menu was really classic, as, you know, like, for example, he loved to make very... old-fashioned dishes who didn't belong to his repertoire, but who he felt was important to continue to protect those dishes, to have them be sort of known for every new generation as well. And
he was evoking a certain narrative, right, and his view of what he thought it meant to be a chef and what French food both was and is and would be, no?
Very much. And I think that's what I've learned the most is that for Paul Bocuse, you can, when he does a soup à la jambe de bois, or when he's, which is kind of a soup of beef with big beef shanks who are coming out, the bones are coming out of the soup, and almost like a pot-au-feu in a way, and he always loved also to entertain for an audience, a group, and sometime often he will create a breakfast, and he kept that tradition. He will create a breakfast for his friend in Lyon. All the suppliers, all the local chef, all the friends will come. And he will make a big breakfast of the most gargantuesque dishes of the past. And his generosity, his passion, his love for friendship, for food, for you know, the sense of holding into the community around the table was very important. And at the Bocuse d'Or, which was... I haven't spoke about the Bocuse d'Or competition, but every 2 years in Lyon, there is this competition who bring 24 countries to Lyon, and after the competition, after the 2 days of competition, the next morning is the plate was putting in the floor of the entrance of the Paul Bocuse auberge, which is made of bronze, and those plates is for the gold, the silver, and the bronze winner of the Bocuse d'Or. And following the plate ceremony, was put on the floor, that with the names and the country and all that, and there is all the lineup of all those countries and names and winners were engraved on the floor as you walk into the auberge. He put out one of the most lavish breakfasts of all time, and that is kind of, you know, a throwback from the past, but at the same time, always been what Paul is about.
Yeah, what a symbol of welcome, of bienvenue and all that. We're going to come back to the Bocuse d'Or because I want to talk about that in the second half. I wanted to ask you one last thing before we take a break. I love this quote that was from Bocuse, that it, and I've taken this out of order because he was responding to a question. But the quote is, this is the quote in English, I'm sure it sounds better in French, but God is already famous, but that doesn't stop the preacher from ringing the church bells every morning. And I think he was defending his reputation as a self-promoter. And in some ways, he was this bigger-than-life self-promoter, but he did it in a natural way. I was curious what you thought, because I think you're maybe not quite as bombastic a fellow despite your success. But what do you think that message and how Paul Bocuse was out there like that kind of teaches today's chef, or what should they really take away from it?
Well, I think Paul Bocuse took the full responsibility of promoting French cuisine and promoting French chef and helping every generation coming. And I think that's his passion. His passion was to make sure that he will always be who he is, but he'll always be also an influence for the next generation and an aspiration and a sort of a driving force in his own industry of it was, I think.
But what do you think? Do you think all? I guess my question was slightly different than about Bocuse himself. But do you think all modern chefs need to be ringing their church bells every day and being on TV and in competitions and to make it work?
No. But I think the only your work is maybe not enough. And I think being able to have opportunity to get involved with other things, being able to have opportunity to express yourself in many different ways, I think that's very important. I think Paul Bocuse also loved, he loved the media and he knew how to entertain them. He knew how to give them something. We were going to give them the opportunity to continue to talk about his work, and he knew that it was important as a whole for the generation to come to be able to rumble the drums about cuisine in Lyon, in France, in the world.
I see. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back, and then we'll get Daniel to talk to us more about the Bocuse d'Or competition that he was just talking about with that famous breakfast that ends it. We'll go back to the beginning before you get to the breakfast. We'll be right back. As promised, we went back into Leo and Lucy's test kitchen to pit Bob's Red Mill protein pancake and waffle mix against Bob's Red Mill grain-free paleo pancake and waffle mix. This time, we swapped out the paleo-friendly coconut oil for still gluten-free sunflower oil. Our findings? We found the change meant that the grain-free's pleasing nutty flavor was less overwhelmed by the coconut. We're also reminded of a pancake cooking tip. You have to use a hot skillet to get the pancakes to sear and rise properly. Hence the old expression, throw out the first pancake. That's usually because your pan wasn't hot enough. It's also made a difference in getting the grain-free pancakes to look and taste like you'd expect them to. In the end, our scrupulous taste testers were pretty satisfied with both outcomes, polishing off 4 apiece in minutes. It's all a reminder that when you're looking for great tasting, quality, healthy food, take it from Leo and Lucy. You can count on Bob's Red Mill. Visit bobsredmill.com today and use the discount code Julia's Kitchen, all one word in all caps, for valuable savings on Bob's Red Mill products, including their pancake and waffle mixes. For those who might not have already been familiar with Monsieur Paul or his creation of the global cooking competition for professional chefs, which is called the Bocuse d'Or, which was started in 1987, I read, to promote a trade fair in Lyon, which is also Danielle's hometown, as he mentioned, and it's often referred to as the Olympics of the chef world. And Danielle is probably one of the best people to bring us up to speed, as he just started jumping ahead into his enthusiasm for all the unique aspects of the Bocuse d'Or. So Danielle, Why do you feel the Bocuse d'Or is so important? I think you feel that, you know, I know from talking to you, it's not just important to chefs, it's important to American chefs. So why does it matter so much?
Well, I think, again, Paul Bocuse, part of his dream in life, as he was, you have to realize then in the 70s, 60s, 70s, he was one of the first chefs who came to America and started to... he was cooking at Mondavi Winery in the late 60s, early 70s. And he brought all his friends with it. Okay, I mean, every time he was coming to California, he would bring two or three chefs with him. And Bob Mondavi was really one of the pioneers in making French chefs famous in America. But also, he was able to present them to American talent at the time also. And Paul Bocuse could see it, and going around the world in Japan, in Australia, in America, in South America. He had a restaurant in the early 80s. He had a restaurant in Rio de Janeiro. He had a restaurant in Tokyo. He had a restaurant in the U.S. He started also with Orlando restaurant. And he could see the merging talent, this kind of youth growing everywhere, which in the kitchen had ambition and wanted to certainly make their own revolution there. And so by the late 80s, he created the Bocuse d'Or. He wanted to do a competition among chefs, which they will come from many different countries. So they weren't 24 countries at the time. Right now, the Bocuse d'Or is a competition where 50 countries or 48 countries are selected, and only 24 are kept to compete in Lyon. So the selection are in Asia, the selection are in South America, and or the Americas, and Europe mostly. And those three continents bring back 24 countries total. And I think this was way before television, way before reality TV, where you know, like Iron Chef or Top Chef or Master Chef,
but it's the same idea. Maybe you should describe, because it's pretty intense. When and originally that you didn't have the sort of double elimination that's from the expansion, but it is very much you train and train and train for what you can do, right, to show off your techniques. But at the end of the day, right, you're given a set and you of ingredients and you go in real time, no?
Absolutely. And what Paul Bocuse wanted to make sure, and this was a competition where there's a public watching you and there's the supporter of every country joining you. So it's really an arena. It's sort of back to the gladiator. Yeah. Where each chef in their box,
but no one dies. No one dies.
No.
but I think that's a great point about the importance of the public audience and public participation as part of it. But then also, don't you think, because there's so much training that goes in that the teams put in to compete, but at the same time, right, when you're there in the moment, it's about the application of your training to the ingenuity that chefs as artists can display, you know?
Very much. And I think the Bocuse d'Or has grown and grown to become one of the most prestigious chef competition in the world. So it does not mean because you are a great chef and maybe a famous chef, you may not like to do competition, and that's fine. But I really believe that for us and in France or in America or in many other countries, the Bocuse d'Or is a wonderful opportunity for young chefs to challenge themselves to their limit, but also to be able to represent their country as a candidate. And I think this is like the Olympic, you know, not, I mean, many people can run, many people can do a lot of different discipline in sport, but that's not mean they're going to go to the Olympic. I think for the Olympic, you have to have the stamina, you have to have the ambition, you have to have the dream, and you have to have the talent. And I think what we always look for every 2 years is to select someone who has all that and be able to compete at the top level. Because going back, America has been participating in most of the Bocuse d'Or in Lyon. And about 10 years ago, Paul Bocuse, 12 years ago, after Gavin Kaysen competed in 07, Paul Bocuse felt that Gavin was a very young chef and he was not supported by the talent Paul Bocuse were proud of in America, such as Thomas Keller, myself, and many other chefs. And he felt that he could have done better if he had been surrounded by the proper support. And mm-hmm. and Gavin was a warrior. He was a hero at the time because he really, at his very young age of 26, he went there and just wanted to represent America. And he did an amazing job, but challenging because he was not assisted so much. And from that, he asked me, Paul Bocuse asked me if I could take care of the Bocuse d'Or in America, if I could really supervise this team. And he wanted also a president, and he wanted Thomas Keller to be the president of the Bocuse d'Or team in the U.S.
So he was getting Olympic serious. You guys were becoming the American Olympic Committee and training committee for the Bocuse d'Or, because he felt that America should be better represented and doing better, but he knew that other countries put a lot more of a nationally organized resource into training for it. Is that right?
Not only that, of course, because when you look at Scandinavia, for example, Denmark is 7 million people, Sweden is 5 million, Norway is another 5 or 7. So basically that those little countries, each one of them were on the podium, and that bothered Paul because he felt like, America, you are so big as a country. There's no way. Why are you not on the podium yourself one day? And
I was going to ask you that. Why do you think why have these Nordic countries that, as you say, have such small populations, have been so successful? Is it training, or is there a lot of ingenuity because their resources are more limited?
Yes, but also because they created a legacy of chef and talent to be trained for it, and so there was each country had a chef who was in charge of this organization, and they were really investing a lot of their time, a lot of their resources and support in order to be able not only to train the candidate who will go to Lyon, but to train also the next candidate maybe, and to be a little bit ahead with it, and to have the opportunity to once they understood how to win, I think that was key for them, is to understand how to win this competition by investing time, and not only money, but time and resources and support to the candidate who was going to do it, and creativity, and really taking it the most seriously, and I think we did that in New York and with Thomas Keller in America, and for the last 6 competitors who have been to Lyon, every time we were getting better, and of course, 3 years ago, we did silver with Phil Tessier, the chef. And last year, we did gold with Matt Peters. And Paul Bocuse could witness both moments.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you think that meant or signified for America to have gotten serious and to have finally won gold in 2017?
Well, of course, it means everything to Paul Bocuse. I mean, to us in America, it was also the first, we wanted to fulfill Paul Bocuse's dream, then America one day will be on the podium and America will have gold. But at the same time, for Thomas Keller, for myself, for everyone associated with the Bocuse d'Or, and we have a foundation now. We created a foundation called Mentor, BKB, and it's all about mentoring the next generation by giving opportunity to give them grants and continue to learn and become great chef one day themselves. I mean, we want them to be better than us. But so, and to also understand the Bocuse d'Or, the competition, and maybe start to dream about it early.
I think that's fascinating what you said, that Bocuse's dream was to have America win.
Oh,
and
yeah.
As a French chef in France, so can we dive into that a little bit more? That's an amazing sense of generosity to say, I think America should win my competition in France, that, you know, it has certainly quite a great deal of French national pride to it. What was that? Is that just his generosity of spirit, or why?
Yes.
Why is that?
And also,
why was that his dream?
You know, Paul Bocuse always said, and he's a little American, because during the war he got injured and he got shot somewhere, and he had to have a blood transfusion, and he was in an American camp, and he had American blood.
So he was infected with his showmanship by the American military.
And he say, you know, then he owe everything to the American, not only to be alive, but to also maybe that American blood gave him that je ne sais quoi, who made him so powerful and maybe so ambitious in life, and also his love for America. I mean, he was really the first French chef ever to sign a contract with Disney. And, you know, everybody thought, I mean, Paul Bocuse with Mickey Mouse, that's a joke. But actually, Disney was so smart to create those pavilions, the French pavilion, the Canadian pavilion, the Mexican pavilion, the Italian pavilion at Epcot. And Paul Bocuse felt this is going to be, I mean, Epcot Center will be the center of the world, and France should be represented, and I understand my responsibility to go there and do it right. And still today, 40 years later, I mean, it's one of the best pavilions in Disney, the French pavilion.
Wow.
And it's run by Jérôme Bocuse, his son, now. And so his love and passion and understanding for America and the talent, he knew about the talent in America. He knew that America could do better. It was just a question of connecting the chef of the right generation into the Bocuse d'Or, and a chef who is also already involve and engage with mentorship, with training young chef, and he felt that Thomas Keller will be the most important chef to be able to support Bocuse d'Or. And
Before we run out of time, I just wanted you to expand upon a little bit what Mentor BKB Foundation is doing. And in particular, I think what shouldn't get lost in the whole focus on competition, which certainly people are very familiar, as you say, from reality TV. But I think this huge theme that runs through between your relationship with Bocuse and Bocuse picking you and Keller is there's a tremendous theme of mentoring other people to excel and do better and continue that. And that's very much a huge part of the Bocuse d'Or.
Yes, but it's also part of Mentor. So Bocuse d'Or, it's in our foundation, Mentor BKB. Bocuse d'Or is a portion we manage, we take care of. We just did the selection for the Americas, and we won gold there in Mexico last week.
No, congratulations.
Yes, so that was the first competition before Lyon next year. We had to select to go to Lyon in 2019. But the Mentor is about, we raise money and we have been given about 1.3 million so far in the last 5 years of grants to young chef. Young chef has to make a compelling presentation of why they deserve a grant from us. And this grant will give the opportunity for the young chef to not only keep his job, but take a sort of a 3 month
sabbatical
and to get a salary from it, to get all expense paid, to travel, and to choose to who else he wants to learn from. And that give him an opportunity to be able to choose, let's say, a chef working in New York want maybe to go and work in California in a 3-star restaurant for 3 months, or they want to go to Europe or Japan or Spain. And those young chefs, they are not students anymore. They are usually cooks, chef de partie, maybe junior sous chef, and they apply. And we give about 25 grant a year, at least. And this is really wonderful and rewarding and transforming young chef life, because they feel like those opportunities never come. You know, you have to quit your job, you have to take a lot of risk, it takes a lot of money to be able to move yourself from one place to another. And being a stagiaire is not given to everyone. And this opportunity give them the opportunity to do a stage and witness.
Yeah, it really helps break down the barriers to entry, so that the people who are most motivated and talented can come.
It's a great reward, and we continue to do that, and we continue to look at education and mentorship, and not only we mentor young chefs to be able to be part of the Bocuse d'Or team and that circle, but also young chefs who maybe are not interested about competition but want to become greater chef and have the opportunity to see something else beside what they do every day in the chef they work with. And this has been very rewarding. Mentor, we have a culinary council of about 50 chefs all over America, and they are all involved with the foundation and supporting us. And we are all supporting each other in a way and doing fundraising.
I was just going to say, I think I didn't expect that the in addition to talking so much about mentorship, that today's episode, the theme would really be all about camaraderie and how important that is. I think that's an exceptional thing to sort of sum up Bocuse's legacy in and of itself.
Very much. So, and that's why I think mentor, it's about this fraternity we have together and this responsibility we have for helping the next generation. Maybe, you know, we did well with the support we had, but we believed that we could have done better if we had what we are bringing today to young chef.
All right, we're going to stop there, because I know that Danielle will have a really good Julia moment to talk about, since he knew her so well. So I don't want to lose or run out of time to do that. So we're going to be right back, and we'll hear Danielle's Julia moment. We'll be right back.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she inspired them in their career. Danielle, what's your Julia moment?
Oh, my Julia moment was, of course, with Julia in their kitchen, cooking a segment where I remember I was opening my restaurant in 25 years ago, because I'm celebrating Restaurant Danielle 25 years ago now, this
Yay.
Year. It's our 25th anniversary. And it was about 25 years ago when I came to cook with Julia in Boston in Somerville. I think it was some...
At her house or somewhere
else? Yeah, at her house.
In Cambridge then?
In Cambridge. That's where the show was run.
Yeah.
And... And the most fascinating thing is that I came in the morning early. They told me to come around 7 o'clock. So I came just before 7 o'clock. And even earlier than that, like maybe 6:30. And Julia was already down on their desk typing recipes, typing letters, typing. And she was already sort of fully engaged and ready to do the show. She was so excited. And we cooked a Côte de Veau and sweet bread with chamomile. And she had used chamomile for other purpose, but never to cook with meat, such as white meat, which chamomile is delicate, and white veal was delicate. And I think I had the most wonderful time with Julia making this recipe, who was one of the dish I had on the menu at Restaurant Daniel when I opened the restaurant 25 years ago. And it always...
And are we going to see it again for the anniversary year?
Yes, but at the same time, you can also, I think, watch that segment online somehow into the archive of Julia's Kitchen.
Wow. Well, that's quite amazing. I mean, that's a pretty hard memory to top. Not only did you cook with Julia in her kitchen for her show, what a wonderful privilege, and I would assume a vividly lasting memory.
Absolutely. I cooked for Julia many, many times at Le Cirque when I was the chef at Le Cirque. I cooked with Julia when I was at the Plaza Athénée in New York. I met Julia. She didn't meet me, but I met her or saw her at the Moulin de Mougins in the late 70s, when I was mid-70s, when I was there in Cannes, near Cannes, because she had a house who was in Valbonne, and she will come and dine at the Moulin with Simone Beck and all her friends down to the Moulin de Mougins. And the station I was working at, the little window where we could see all the guests coming in and out on the way to the parking lot. And so one day I saw Julia passing by, and of course we all knew that was Julia because she came to the kitchen to say hello to Roger Verger. So, you know, when you're a young cook, you stay on your side and you don't say anything, but you witness that. And that was then the time. And I had many occasions.
Well, what an amazing full circle to go from that meeting or sort of exposure in the 70s to coming back to her legacy podcast. That's a great way to close up. Thank you so much for joining us, Danielle. I really appreciate it, and especially for all you do. And someday you'll have to write a book about your secret to doing more than any other human being can do.
Thank you. And I want to say about Julia, and 3 years ago, I rented a house in Valbonne, and that was the house of Simone Beck, next door to the little house of Julia, where I was every day looking at the kitchen and imagining how Julia was living down there. It was a fun memory.
I remember seeing you right before you were doing that. That's so lovely that you were able to do that, and that we're both able to carry on all of these people's very important legacy and keep them alive for future generations.
Fond memories, absolutely.
Well, thanks for being here, Danielle, and thank you for listening. Let us know what you think about today's show. You can reach us via email, or even you can send us a voice memo, contact@juliachildfoundation.org. You can follow us on Facebook, search at Julia Child, and you can follow the foundation on Twitter. Our Twitter handle's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T Shulkin, T-S-C-H-U-L-K-I-N. We're on Instagram. You can search Julia Child Foundation, all one word. If you want to learn more about Danielle and his many extraordinary restaurants, including the 25th anniversary year at Danielle in New York, which I can personally recommend, go to daniellenyc.com. And you can follow Danielle on social media. He's very switched on. And his handle is at Danielle Boulud. It's B-O-U-L-U-D. And he's also on Facebook at either at Chef Danielle Boulud or Restaurant Danielle. Thanks to WGBH for the Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef. And thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, David Tadashore. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Veltorni. Thanks to all you listeners for coming back for Season 2. Please remember to give us a review so new listeners can discover what they missed in Season 1. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss upcoming episodes. A reminder that we're now on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, so downloads will be available one day later than you might have been used to in Season 1. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.